Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Mogwai Podcast. I'm Amanda Stanley, and in this episode I talk to the support act for Mogwai's North American tour, Xander Harris. We discuss synthesizers, the local electro scene in Austin, the influence Mogwai has had on him as a musician, and what he hopes Mogwai fans will take away with them when seeing him support the band on this run of dates.
I just want them to see the possibility of electronic music. And I think Mogwai in the last couple of records has really framed electronic music into their world that I think makes it really digestible for people who wouldn't actually pursue electronic music as a listening habit.
I also catch up with Mogwai's front of house sound engineer Kenny McLeod and their guitar and keyboard technician Gavin Maxwell to discuss what goes on behind the scenes of every Mogwai show, in which they also share some insight into what happens when things go awry on the night.
The amps had all been stored in a damp room, and I think I blew up 14 heads in about 10 shows. Until I literally had none left, and at the Festival Hall in London, Barry just had to walk off because we had no more amps. We'd literally used every single, and there was like flames coming out the back, you know, just like, there's nothing I can do.
Be sure to hit subscribe to keep up to date with all future episodes as they drop, and head to mogwai.co.uk to find a full list of tour dates. And now here is my conversation with Justin Sweat, better known as the electronic artist Xander Harris. I began by asking him to talk about what the electronic scene is like where he is based in Austin, Texas.
Electronic scene here is huge, but it was not something that was ever talked about until Stranger Things happened with Survive. We had been doing it for years, like all the holodeck bands, we all play together, like we're all friends, we're that's what I mean, like there's no competitive things or anything like that. Like, you know, it was Xander Harris, Troller, Sleeper Hold, and then it would be like Troller, Sleeper Hold, Missions, and then it would be Sleeper Hold, Survive, Shane English, or just all these different people. And then like you have people here who have worked with Lies, and you know, that record label, and like all these different labels, and no one talks about it. No one knows. In Austin, like, there's still like, it's still a guitar town primarily, like, and that's fine. Like, it's the Psych Fest, Levitation, Black Angels, Reverberation Society, and that stuff's great. It's cool, like totally awesome. But that's also, which I'm sure is like in Glasgow, it's each different genre, country, punk, electronic, what have you, in Austin is so deep with a lot of people that you're just overwhelmed, because there's like 30 guys at the show who are legitimately badass, and you're just kind of going, what the hell? Like, all in one place? I gotta figure out Saturday, I gotta try to see three of these people, and they're all playing at the same time. Like, you know, it's stuff like that. But I would say electronic music in America right now is going through this really, really huge, I think it's the best it's ever been. Not since Detroit and Chicago do I think that on the underground and beneath like the surface has it ever been this strong. There's so much good stuff out there. And whether it's industrial or techno or, you know, minimal or whatever the term of the week is, it's all the way around. I feel like in America, like, we're finally on equal footing with Europe. Like, we're finally, like, there's all of these people, like, there's a lot of stuff going on in LA too. Like, that was the other thing that was really cool, is there's a lot of really good electronic music in Los Angeles and Chicago again, and like places like Madison, and just, I don't know, it's cool. I think music is the best it's ever been, in my opinion. Like, it feels very Wild West. Like, I kind of like that major labels have died, like a reboot thing has happened. Like, I'm one of those people who's totally embraced streaming, totally embraced digital. I think it's really great because it allows people of low income to hear really cool music. Because when I was a kid, we had radio. Well, now the radio doesn't do anything but play like Pearl Jam songs from 20 years ago. So I feel like a kid with a cheap laptop can go and listen to Bandcamp and find the greatest thing he's ever heard. And I think that's really cool.
Did you grow up in Texas?
I did. I grew up in West Texas. So I grew up in the middle of nowhere. I was born in Big Spring, and then my parents, when I was one, moved to Midland, the land of Friday Night Lights. The other famous band from that place is Explosions in the Sky. We all went to like high school together and everything. I like those guys a lot. They're really cool. And I think it forced us to be the strong individuals that we are. There's no one weird like you in that town. And now that I'm back there and I've been working in like this like organic food cafe and everything, like it's pretty funny how I do have this like Gareth moment from Little Britain where I do feel like the only goth in the village.
Yeah.
It's pretty weird because it's, you know, oil and it's a little rednecky at times, but it's cool. I mean, at the same time, there's a lot of space and there's a lot of options to explore. And as kids, we would put on shows and we would go to Lubbock and, you know, we did this whole DIY thing back before Facebook, and it was fun. It was cool. There was a lot of just driving around, and it was a good place to grow up because it just gave you the space to think. Culturally, it has its quibbles, but so does, I don't know, no place is perfect.
Do you feel like perhaps having nothing around you kind of pushed all the individuals to kind of form something of themselves? Just from sheer boredom, you know?
Yeah, as an individual, I think it was really good because it forced you to, you went and you grabbed a magazine and you said, those dudes look weird. I want to know what that is. Like, I remember specifically I bought Propaganda Magazine, which was this goth magazine. These dudes had like the giant Nick Cave hair and black lipstick and all this stuff. And I was like, outwardly, these dudes look exactly how I feel on the inside. I have to know what this is. You know, it's just... there was a lot of visualization. It was interesting. You would buy stuff just on record covers alone, or it was labels. I remember when I was a kid, like it was like Sub Pop and Discord and K Records and Up Records,
yeah.
And like all the Northwest stuff, which was like really big influence on us out there. Cause it was in between, like Lubbock was in between Albuquerque and Austin and Dallas. So like we were fortunate, and a lot of these bands would come and stop in Lubbock and play to like 25 of us, 14, 15 year old snot nosed kids who were like, Carp is in our living room. This is cool. You know, like, or Light Vault or like all this stuff. And it was just like so cool. And it inspired us, a lot of us, like to just like, we always say like, be a lifer. Like we're lifers. Like we're going to be those guys until we're 70 on a couch playing music in some dude's living room. You know, like it's fine, you know?
So, growing up as well, like what was your first instrument that you learned to play, and does it remain your primary instrument today?
Yeah, drums. I started when I was really young, and I was marching band and did school and performance and composition and all that kind of stuff. Synth music and everything. It's interesting because I got really into it, and my best friend, she had a synthesizer. She had this Oberheim, and I remember just this kid from Texas, and she had this Oberheim synthesizer, and I was just like, oh my God, what is that? That is the coolest. And it made weird sounds, and they always needed a drummer. So I would play drums in like 8 bands when I was growing up, like all these different bands. And so I could borrow gear. I'd be like, cool, I'll play your band, but can I borrow your 4-track and your synth? Cause I want to learn how to play. And I just started to slowly teach myself guitar and drums and bass and all that other stuff. Because again, I spent long periods of time where, you know, your friends can't come over because it's midnight and you can't be loud and all this other stuff. So I started teaching myself how to play a bunch of different instruments so that I could, boredom, write music. You know, I just started just like writing music by myself. Like it just, but drums was, and I still play drums. Like I still consider myself a drummer. I laugh. I kind of tongue-in-cheek tell people, like, yeah, when I say synthesis, because I play piano, I know notes, I can read music, but I'm not Rachmaninoff. Like, I'm an okay saloon player, and that's about it. Yeah, it's okay.
I imagine discovering synthesizers, and that's just like a whole other world, and that even now is obviously still progressing as technology develops. In terms of gear, what's your go-to, like when you sit down to make a new song and make some demos, like is there like a piece of equipment that you always kind of find yourself going to in the room to start that?
Yeah, two pieces of gear that I always use is It's the Blue Electribe. It's a Korg. Korg makes both things. I'm a big Korg enthusiast because I just like the way they sound. And I always use this Korg Electribe EMX sequencer, drum machine, whatever. And I start doing the beats and stuff because I can play it. And since I'm a drummer, I can start with the rhythms. And then I always work within keys. Like, it's interesting. And then I use a King Korg to write the bass lines and the melodies. And I chart it. I start writing stuff down, like what, you know, I'll pick. Sometimes I'll even do like an oblique strategies like Brian Eno, where I'm just like, hey, write something in B sharp major, or, you know, B sharp minor. Okay, cool. And then I just start figuring out, like, okay, well, B sharp minor is this many notes, and it has this, and this is flat, and this is not. And I start writing, but those are the two pieces. I use a King Korg synthesizer, which is really cool because it has real piano sounds, and it has synth sounds, and it has like all these things that I really love. And then I like the Electribe because it has all the rhythms and everything, and I can save it. I have a little media card, and I just save everything, and then I can start, and then I'll start dumping stuff into Ableton or Logic or Pro Tools, depending on my mood that day. I used to be in IT, like before Xander Harris started doing better. I did tech support. I worked at Apple. I worked at AMD. I've been a Mac guy since I was a kid. And so I couldn't make money working in recording studios because I went to school for sound engineering and had a synthesis class and everything. And that was another way I got into it. And then IT became a way to feed myself by accident. But technology is a part of the writing process too. There are times where I'll take a controller and I know that I can load up a certain piano sound in Logic or whatever, and I can start writing. It's weird. Oh, the way I write is interesting because I start off with bass and melody and rhythm, and I work around, and then I'll start making it ugly or distorted or reverbed or using a synth sound. But it's so funny. If people heard it, it's like this cheesy MIDI bass, you know, Seinfeld sounding MIDI bass with a piano. Yeah. It's like, who wants to be the cheesiest like dude on the block? It's pretty funny, like, but it works. Yeah. So I'm like, if it sounds good with these cheesy settings, then okay, it'll sound good when I actually like get into the design of it. So
yeah, totally. Being a solo artist, do you find that when you're in the studio and kind of immersed in that mode, do you find that to be like, can you find yourself getting lost in kind of an insular environment? Do you find yourself just completely shutting off for long periods of time?
Yeah. I will go into a hole, but I've had to get a notebook. And what I've started doing is I'm working on another record for Rock Ash. I'm working on the follow-up for the last record. And I've written the whole thing, and I'm halfway through recording it. And one, I'd say side A, I don't know, I might change the track listing, but side A is done. But I force myself into, okay, record all the basic tracks and, you know, perform them. Don't just copy and paste. Don't be lazy. Like, I play each part like it's a performer so that I'll remember when I want to play it live. Like, it's a really good way for it to get stuck in my brain. And then I go into mixing mode. Like, okay, everything's recorded. Now I'm just going to mix. And then once I feel really happy with that, then it's okay, we're going to master it. And then I go into mastering mode. And then I sit and listen for 40,000 hours and pick it apart and hate it and, you know, re-record it or, you know, redo it or remix it or take it apart. But yeah, in this conversation, I'm already in my head. It goes into this long tunnel of, and there are times I work a lot because I don't even have a goldfish. Like, it's just me. I'm a solo artist in all aspects of my life. I'm a single guy with a laptop and a keyboard. Like, so I just work. I've always looked at it as work. And I don't know, dignity of labor. Like, it's just like one of those things where I kind of like the process because I think it keeps me from being depressed. And I have a lot of energy and I'm always on the go, go, go. And I don't sleep a lot. I've naturally been that way since I was a child. So I just, Yeah. The long story short, it goes into a very long tunnel.
Yeah, cyclical tunnel of never, of like final. This one's the final one.
I think on California Chrome, there's like 44 finals of one like in a folder, and I kept all of them. And I'm like, well, if there's ever a special edition years from now, you can hear how this is remarkably different than what actually came out. You know, so
yeah. Here's my cheesy Seinfeld release.
I have those. They are hidden away, though, in a very, very, very small encrypted folder that no one will ever find, because I would be embarrassed, I think.
You could, like, release it under a different moniker, and people would be like, that sounds kind of similar, but surely not.
Yeah, I could Twitter beef with myself and sue myself. That would be kind of funny.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So in terms of taking instruments on the road, like how does that differ to what you use in the studio? Obviously, you're a bit limited by what you can carry. What do you find when you're taking even just like new music out on the road on this tour with Mogwai? Like, how do you decide what the essential pieces that are definitely going to be with you to make up a live setup?
I have two rules, and one is I like to give myself some space to improv. So I learn the songs really, really well. So there's no bum notes or anything like that, so that I can kind of experiment with sounds. But I also have a little notebook that says, you know, these sounds are going to work great. Try it, see what happens. But the live show, I grew up at a time where when you would go and see a band, their performance and their live show was nothing like the album. And I always really liked that. So I try to do the same thing where I'll speed the tempo up a little bit. I'll strip it down and make it a little bit more minimal in some cases, but still huge. But my rule is, can I replace it on the road? No vintage gear. Like, I will not bring anything vintage with me on the road unless I absolutely have to. Like, everything that I have right now, I could get replaced at a Guitar Center. I could pop all my settings and everything and just do it in a half hour and I would be fine. So I always take my Mini Logue and my King Korg with me, because those are the two synths that I use the most. And I can use the Librarian and set my sounds and do my splits and everything before I go. And then all my sequences and everything are on a little sequencer. And I try to, since it's just me, I drive myself. I'm in a little four door standard sedan. It's like I'm the Chuck Berry of synth, you know. I just like roll in with my stuff and I'm like, how's it going, guys? And then I do the show, and then I can load it into my trunk and I take off, because I like it to be hidden. So, you know, knock on wood, nothing gets stolen. And I just want it to be able to be replaced and sound good. I mean, I do fret over the live performance aspect. Like, I put a lot of time and thought into it to make it a little bit different, but not too different. And I learn a lot of the catalog. I try not to play the same set every night, but I also try to, you know, like, if somebody really, like, I always get requested Tan Skin Dress. And 3 or 4 years ago, I made this, like, statement to my friends, like, I don't want to ever play that song again. I've been playing this song for 8 years. I hate it. Like, I just am over it. But then you don't really, like, when you put something out, I feel like as an artist, like, once it's in the world, you don't really have any control over how people react to it or what they want. And now I'm like, I'm gonna play the hell out of that song.
What do you feel is the most important takeaway you want new audiences who are perhaps like Mogwai fans and going to be seeing you for the first time? What do you think is the most important thing that you want them to take away from your live show?
That electronic music isn't just some dude pushing buttons, that it is a musician. And I hope they like it. And I hope that they like it enough to where I can see them again next year, like a couple of months later, and do it again. Like, you know, on my own tour or with someone else, or I just want them to see the possibility of electronic music. And I think Mogwai in the last couple of records has really framed electronic music into their world that I think makes it really digestible for for people who wouldn't actually pursue electronic music as a listening habit. I think the new album, Every Country Sun, is incredible. And there's so much synth on it, but it still sounds like Mogwai, which I think is incredibly difficult, and to their credit. So, and I'm, of course, stoked that I got asked, and I'm, like, totally pinching myself and just, like, don't die before the 20th, you know, like, don't... I'm like trying to live in it, like the boy in the bubble. I'm like, don't get sick. Don't do anything stupid. You know, be vegan and, you know, exercise and be nice, you know, like, but yeah, it's, I hope that they come across, I hope that they learn about the scene that I come from, the electronic DIY scene, like, and explore it and see the possibilities of electronic music.
Xander Harris will be supporting Mogwai on all their dates across North America, and you can find out more about his music at xanderharris.bandcamp.com. In a bid to get behind the scenes of Mogwai's live shows, I headed to their Castle of Doom recording studios in Glasgow to catch up with the front of house engineer Kenny McLeod and guitar and keyboard technician Gavin Maxwell whilst they were back in town on a week break from the EU tour. Kenny and Gavin are just two members of the small Mogwai touring family who work tirelessly every day on the road to ensure Mogwai's live shows come together and run smoothly every night around the world.
How do you explain what you do without it sounding like you just stand there? Hi, my name is Kenny McLeod. I mix front of house sound for the band. That means I mix the sound for the audience that you hear in the room at night.
And I'm Gavin Maxwell, and I look after stage right, guitars and keyboards, which would be your left if you're watching it.
To begin with, I want to first ask both of you, how did you first get into... like the jobs that you're doing now? So for you, Gavin, how did you first get into teching for bands?
I just kind of did. My friends were in one and I just hung about with them, and then just slowly spiraled into now, like 12 years on. So just non-stop touring, basically. Yeah, you don't really learn apart from doing, I guess.
For people who might not know what exactly like your job entails, how would you describe what your day of work looks like?
It involves a lot of pointing in the morning of like getting the local crew to put everything on stage and unpack the trucks. We set everything up when we've tried to do it as fast as possible so then we can all drink coffee and hang out. And a lot of restringing to do, and just a lot of general day-to-day maintenance and upgrades and little bits, and it's a big evolving. It never stops getting better, basically.
If you've got lots of restringing to do, is there like a competition of who can restring a guitar the fastest?
No, there should be though, because it would get very, very competitive and probably make us do it faster. But yeah, it's quite fast. I've got a drill that does it really, really fast, so yeah, I'm getting kind of good at it.
How did you get into engineering for front of house? Did you study it? Or?
Well, yeah, I did study it at college when I was 15, but that I don't really think that much of the experience that I had at college at that time was useful and transferable. I predominantly started working when I was 16 in local pubs and clubs doing sound, and moved from there to touring with bands, studio work, production.
In a kind of day in the life for yourself, how does your day unfold?
Wake up, head into the venue, find some breakfast, meet your locals for the day, your hosts as I like to call them, the local house sound guys who normally have a certain degree of nervousness because they've heard that the band are loud and they don't want their system destroyed. So I generally win them over, find out what the noise restrictions are going to be for the day, set up my mixing desk and all my associated peripherals, and from there I'll tune the system with a song called Africa by Toto.
Africa by Toto.
Well, 80s music is mastered generally at a much lower level than modern music, which you've probably heard of the loudness war, the constant efforts for people to have their music seem louder than others. Thankfully, that's dying off thanks to Spotify and iTunes and everything having loudness units as the measurement. But Africa by Toto has a lot of dynamic range, and so it's more akin to a live performance than a piece of music which has been recorded, mixed, and then mastered, and had several stages after the mixing process, which we can't have in the live environment. I've played it on every sound system that I've used, pretty much, so I can tell what I need to do for the room.
You've just come back from the first kind of run at the EU touring, and then you're heading off to the States. Going through so many different venues, how do you approach making the same kind of consistency day after day?
That's a real challenge for me, I think, more than perhaps some of the other guys, because obviously the backline guys and the monitor guy, although he doesn't have his own wedges, they predominantly travel with all the equipment that they use every night, whereas I have to use whichever PA's been provided for us or is in-house to the venue every day. So it does give a degree of challenge each day to try and make it sound like our show. The Gav will probably talk about various power issues and things that are thrown up to them from... Where was that we were recently, which was next to...
Where were we? Milan? Yeah. No, Munich. We were next to a railway line and we were in a metal box. So you turn all the amps on and there's no way of... You press... We've got special boxes that normally make everything go silent, and then you press that and it just made it even worse. So, like, all our get-out-of-jail-free boxes were doing absolutely nothing. So you just need to... tell everybody, you're like, well, that's just what it is today, and there's no getting around it.
Yeah. Other days, though, there are solutions to those problems whenever it's just a mechanical problem or an earthing issue or whatever. Yeah. But consistency is the key. We, with the show, although we didn't have any pre-production time on it, we, within a week of it, myself and the lighting guy, Phil, definitely had a presentation out front that we were aiming to duplicate every night. And part of the challenge of moving around venues is making that happen with the different restrictions on space, the speakers you're using. Local noise regulations in different countries are very different, which is a problem for Mogwai sometimes. There's a lot of noise restrictions coming in certain countries, like Switzerland, for instance, that can be quite low compared to what the public expect, even.
So how do you get around a problem like that, like you said, for a band like Mogwai, who, when you go to a Mogwai show, you very much so expect to kind of...
Yeah, in Switzerland and anywhere else, the first step is to communicate with the people that are going to be measuring it, find out what the potential fines and issues are going to be if and when you do go over it. You sweet talk them a bit,
yep.
Try and get them on side, let them know that you're really excited to be doing this here, and that obviously they are integral to the show, they can make and break the show, so you make sure they're part of the team. And then the next step's to make sure that they're measuring it in a responsible way, using an average over time, an LEQ, and making sure it's measured A-weighted rather than C-weighted. This is why I'm saying you won't be able to use any of this.
Well, you can explain that. Explain that now to us. What's the difference between the two?
Well, A-weighting and C-weighting measure the audio spectrum differently, and as a result, show different levels. It's the easiest way to describe it. Then within that time period, we have to manage how much we're allowed to do with peaks and average. Generally speaking, as long as it's measured as an average, then... and it's a responsible level, then we'll be fine, because I can drive the set around the crescendos to make sure that we have enough headroom to reach those. The downside is when people give you non-professional measurement equipment and expect you to adhere to it, and at those points I just have to put my foot down and refuse.
And so for you, Gavin, being on the tech side, on the side of stage,
yep,
what are the challenges that you've seen kind of consistently come up again and again?
Definitely the noise levels, yeah, are the thing that's affecting you massively.
Yeah, because we try and make the stage as quiet as possible, so then Kenny's get as much headroom out front to actually mix it. Because if the stage volume's like relative, if it's 3 dB out for Kenny, he's only got a 3 dB window to actually make it louder. So there's been shows that he'll shout me over and I'll go down, he'll mute the guitars and he'll be like, there's no difference. He's like, go turn them down. You're like, okay, cool. And then your amps don't work as hot, and so we're currently trying to make it even quieter with new boxes, and we're currently, so it's a work in progress, show by show.
But it's a fine line, isn't it, Gav? Because the tone comes from the amps yep. driving, and yep. we, when you turn down the amplifiers, they don't just get quiet, they get weedy, mm-hmm. and we are working to make sure that we're always on the side of them being powerful at the same time as mm-hmm. being loud enough that the band can get feedback and feel the impression of the sound, but at the same time that we have control out front and make sure that we can deliver a quality mix every night.
Yeah, just the consistency is key for, yeah, it's all about just making it the exact same every day, or at least as close to the same every day. And if it doesn't, then it's more apparent if it's not to everybody on the stage than it is to anybody else, but it's still, if it's there, then it still annoyed us, and then it'll be worked on as soon as you wake up the next morning. We'll have a discussion over dinner or whatever, or over a beer at night, and then go to bed early and then get up and start work again, make sure it's back to exactly where we were, or if not better.
And so that's something that I find quite interesting when I was talking to Stuart and Barry, and they were saying when they take the record out on the road, they're obviously in the studio when they're rehearsing, then they have full control. For them, they were like, oh, we don't really know what it'll be like front of house, or like yeah. on the night if something breaks or something's not coming through. There must be like a real kind of trust yeah. bond that's built over time. So I guess my question is like, how has that dynamic formed over the years for you guys?
Well, with me, it's more we build fail-safes in, so if anything does ever break, then it's easily troubleshooted first, because you don't want to be running about like a headless chicken on stage trying to work out what's went wrong. So, for instance, for my in-ear monitors to hear the band, I pan it, so I've got, the way I stand is like side on, so I only listen to 8 channels, and I've got them panned, so I know exactly, like in a spatial sense, what's went wrong. So it's really easy to troubleshoot that way. I think it's just absolute trust in a way. With I phoned Barry yesterday, and I was like, "Do you want to use these amps for this show coming up in Iceland?" And he's like, "Yep, don't care." He's like, "I thought that might have been the answer." And he's like, "So you just, it just evolves. Like, you know that." If something can't be fixed, you know that they'll know that everything that's possibly been done has been done to make it, and if it can't, it just can't. And that's
yeah. I think where the trust comes from in there as well, partially comes from the fact that Mogwai don't generally, or have never in the time I've worked with them, had a production manager. Therefore, everyone is starkly responsible for their roles and their departments. There's nowhere to hide, there's no one to blame for any decisions that have been made apart from yourself, so it gives everyone a sense of ownership over the project, which I don't think that crew on a lot of tours have. A lot of other tours, the production manager will make all the decisions as to what's happening, what equipment's being used, how it's travelling, but on this it's far more of a each department is responsible for their own outcomes.
And for you guys, how does the setup differ? Gavin, you're saying it's always evolving in terms of yep. the tech side of things. With this new album, Every Country's Son, how different is that to the previous tours that you've done with them?
It's all like a gradual progression. So like for Gav, it probably seemed like there was a big change, but we had been doing Atomic, which Gavin wasn't on, and Atomic was kind of like a bridge between where we left it on Rave Tapes and starting Every Country's Son, bringing in Alex on guitar and keyboards, having a second keyboard set up, changing the stage set up very slightly because of that. It's always been a gradual progression it's quite seamless. It's just people's ideas, and the band benefit from the experience that their crew are gaining. When they're on off time, we'll all be off touring with other people, and through that you see other ways of working, other processes, things that you think you could bring to the Mogwai tour. Yeah, everyone has a kind of unseen area, but it's key. It's like the old adage, fail to prepare, prepare to fail.
Yep. I think that's it, yeah. And again, like changing countries and stuff like that, there must just be so much preparation that you guys have to do, because you're quite a small unit when you think about it in terms of how big Mogwai are as a band, but also, like you said, that they don't even have a production manager on tour with you,
it's all in-house. It's just all of us together, and what is there, 11 of us or 12 of us, including the band?
Within the touring party. Yeah. In the United States, there'll be 12 of us, including the merchandise guy.
Yep.
But he's our t-shirt seller guy that we pick up in the USA.
So that's like quite a small party if you're including the band with that. So yeah. Do you guys all just get on fine now? You're all just like settled like a family?
Yeah, I mean, we're all like a settled, dysfunctional family. Certain members of the family don't need to get up the next day until a lot later than other members of the family. Some members of the family need to get up and make breakfast, let's call it, while others just need to get up for dinner. Yeah. Also, you know, we don't have a separate crew bus on the Mogwai tours, so we are literally all in it together. I think we all know each other's personalities,
yeah, and body language.
Yeah, and everyone,
you know, to this like beeline her, you know, to stay away if somebody's here. Like, it can be, you can find it out in a hello in the morning. You're like, how's it going? And you're like, and then you're like, okay, go.
Yeah,
give him a bit of space.
You can quickly learn when to respect other people's personal space. There's no literal personal space on the road, so everyone takes it where they can get it, and you can always tell when someone's just having some time to themselves.
Is there anything about each of your jobs individually that people might not realise is something that, that you're responsible for, and also something that you personally take great pride in?
I think for like non-roadies, the whole concept of what we do is not really known in people's minds. I think people think there's a lot more glory in it and a lot less grafting. But there's a definite balance between glory and graft.
Yeah, I don't really know. There isn't much. Really,
but there is if you speak to the normal non-touring professional, because they literally will think that you walk on stage with a couple of guitars at the point that the show's starting and hand them to a guy.
Yeah, it's not been a 12-hour day before.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess that. There's just, it's very hard to... Well, like, you wake up and sometimes you can't move your hands because you've lifted like 3 tons worth of stuff twice a day. And because we've got no singer as well, we do 6 in a row. So there's a lot of times that we physically can't. We're all complaining about quite a lot. And just to actually keep saying is kind of being proud of that, to just keep going and not complaining. And
yeah, keeping morale up is an important part of the tour, especially within all jobs, especially I think within the technical performing arts. Moaning's a big part of it, and moaning's quite contagious, and you always have to make sure that you've not caught a bit of that.
Yep. And or you get them out in the morning,
yeah,
which you can pass off as just being tired,
yeah,
or in the pub at night. But that's I mean, you obviously confide in your colleagues, but at the same time you have to try and make sure that you're keeping the tour on. We all have a responsibility for keeping the tour going in the right direction. If anyone's really, really pulling against the tour, then it becomes that everyone's dragging them along.
Yeah.
Is there anything specifically that you can think of that is kind of like a nightmare situation when you go to work?
I actually have nightmares about the show sometimes. I had one the other week that I dropped all the show laptops down a lift shaft and I don't know why I was on a bit of wood on the top of a lift shaft, but yeah, I dropped them all. But yeah, I guess if all the, well, on the, my first shows on rave tapes, the amps had all been stored in a wet, not a wet room, but like a damp room, and I think I blew up 14 heads in about 10 shows until I literally had none left. And at the Festival Hall in London, Barry just had to walk off because we had no more amps. We'd literally used everything, and there was like flames coming out the back, you know, just like, there's nothing I can do. So yeah, that's pretty nightmarish. But yeah, there's so many different things that if audio stops for me or Kenny, it's something's went terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah, the worst thing that can happen to me is losing power to the, or communication between my front of house sound system, and obviously there's a cable or series of cables that run from that right round the venue to the stage to then come through the speakers, and if the sound stops then seconds feel like minutes. Mm-hmm. And when there's an audience there and the band are still playing, perhaps. I've never had it happen. Happened once in Chile, but that it's not happened since then. Yeah.
And so what does the rest of your week look like before you head out?
I'm going to rebuild Alex's pedal board today, actually, because I don't like it at the moment. And which I'm saying it's always evolving and getting better.
So what does that involve doing?
Cutting off all the connectors and resoldering a different type of connector on. And then what else? We need to prep the gear, get it all ready in a different pile than it is at the moment.
Yeah, I've got to prep my equipment as well, pull apart the bits from my setup that are going to the States versus the stuff that we'll be hiring locally. I've been working this week with the audio company in the United States to finalise exactly what equipment we're getting and trying to work out how we can downsize it to fit within the trailer that we're going to be touring with.
Yeah, last time the trailer kind of snapped off the back of the bus because it was too heavy. And we had to get a NASCAR welder to come down and weld it back together, basically. Yeah. So it was a bit sketchy every night going to bed, like, oh no, will it drag the bus off the motorway? But yeah, so we're trying to cut down on, because there's a lot of equipment, there's a lot of weight in the equipment, which if it was in the UK, it would be illegal, but in America, they don't care.
Do you guys have to go out like a good few days early to start like prepping all that stuff before the first show?
No, we just need to, like, sometimes last time we were on Las Vegas Strip, weren't we? Yeah. Outside the Hard Rock Cafe with so many extra flight cases that we had to work out a plan of. We're like, nope, it's basically lights. You're like, nope, you're not taking that. You're not taking, because then there's a priority list of one, the equipment, so that can a show can happen. And then it's Kenny's stuff and monitors, so it's all the audio has to go in first before, because if there's nothing to light up, then there's no point in having lots of lights.
Either of you ever worked in the hydro?
Yes.
How's that for you?
I production managed a show for Bell and Sebastian there last year. It was a great show. It was really successful from our point of view. We achieved most of what we were hoping to achieve. The hydro has its own set of challenges in that I think a lot of the bands who strive to play the hydro in Glasgow are Glasgow bands who can sort of poke their head above their usual show sizes to do the big hometown show. The downside to that is that a lot of their fans then feel that the show's slightly removed from the kind of shows they're used to seeing the band do. And, you know, the way that audiences like to feel an ownership of the band, the kind of true fans sort of idea. So it's the balance of keeping the two, the kind of walk-up audience versus the regular Mogwai fans. It's definitely our lighting designer, Phil, has been working very tirelessly on it. He has a show which he's devised, but he'll still need to have as much time as possible to program it, and it will be for this specific design. It will be the first time probably that he's had to put it in with that equipment, and that's a real challenge for the lighting department. When we did Festival Number 6, it was the first proper show of this campaign. We did a warm-up the night before, but we had our usual lighting guy and two techs or three techs, and they'd been working overnight getting everything in. Literally, we hadn't seen it until the show started. But everyone's got faith that Phil will deliver a really high quality show within the budget that he has available, although I'm sure he always pushes the budget as far as he can.
Absolutely.
Thanks again to Xander Harris and Kenny and Gavin too for taking the time out of their busy schedules to talk. Mogwai's latest record, Every Country's Sun, is out now and is available via their website at mogwai.co.uk, where you will also find a full list of tour dates too. Follow Mogwai on Twitter at Mogwai Band, and be sure to hit subscribe to this podcast to keep up to date with all future episodes as they are released.